Okay, the February 9, 2012 meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy is called to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 3:08 p.m. And for the record, we do have a quorum. We have with us co-chair Representative Pruitt, Representative Lynn, Sadler, Peterson, Tuck, and myself chairing Representative Foster. And we do have excused Representative Olson. And then also at the table here, I'd like to recognize that we have Representative Kathy Munoz here to join with us. And I believe Peggy Wilson may be coming later. At this time, I'd like to remind everybody, if you could please turn off your cell phones, and that will interfere with the sound system that we have here. So the purpose of today's meeting is to hear a presentation on the current status of the Southeast Alaska Integrated Resource Plan. With us today, we have the following personnel from the AEA, Alaska Energy Authority. We have Sarah Fisher-Goad, the Executive Director, Jim Strandberg, the Project Manager, Karsten Rodvik, the External Affairs, Kevin Harper, Southeast Alaska Integrated Resource Plan Project Director for the consulting firm Black & Veatch. And I'd like to invite AEA and those folks forward here to go ahead and start with your presentation. And as usual, please state your name and affiliation for the record and proceed with your testimony. We appreciate your coming, and looks like there's a lot of interest in this, and so we'll be taking public testimony after, so committee first and then public. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm going to be very brief and then remove myself from the table for Mr. Strandberg and Mr. Harper. For the record, my name is Sarah Fisher-Goad. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority, and thank you very much for having a hearing on the Southeast Integrated Resource Plan. I know there's a great deal of interest, and again, I want to keep my comments brief since there is certainly a lot of folks that want to provide some public testimony to the committee. I do want to this has been a plan that's been in the works for over a year. We have a working group that was formed with Southeast residents in the executive summary that lists the members of the working group. I did want to recognize at least three that I see in the room. Mr. Rick Harris from Sea Alaska, he chaired the working group. Mr. Powell Southland is here, and also Mr. Bob Grimm. And I apologize if there are others in the room that came in after after I sat down. But I did want to thank their efforts and their work with the Alaska Energy Authority and Black & Veatch to produce the plan. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Strandberg and Kevin Harper to provide their overview of the plan.
And just to reflect in the record there, we have been joined by Representative Peggy Wilson. Thank you, Peggy. And please state your name for the record and your affiliation.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jim Strandberg. I am the AEA Project Manager for the Southeast IRP Project.
Thank you. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Our presentation to you today will be by Mr. Kevin Harper, the Black & Veatch Project Director for this project. And after Mr. Harper's remarks, I have just two or three slides to perhaps reflect on the possible beneficial effects on the cost of energy for three different communities in Southeast Alaska that could occur under this plan. And, you know, I would provide that just for perspective and generally to indicate that we are looking very hard at this plan and also considering the outcomes, the possible outcomes from it. First, just a few introductory comments. We've really sought to pursue a public bottoms-up process that involved as many people in Southeast Alaska in this planning process. Ms. Fisher-Goad mentioned, we've brought together an advisory work group. The chairman of that work group is Mr. Rick Harris from Sea Alaska. And there are some 22, I believe, members of that advisory group that met monthly over the over this planning process, and many of the issues that are dealt with in the plan were discussed at great length during those advisory group meetings over the year. It's pretty clear that this plan, because it's an integrated approach that looks at both heating costs and electricity costs, it as a foundation to an economic development plan, is going to affect a lot of different people, and it's very gratifying to see all of the different people here that potentially may testify on the plan. AEA has taken the plan under advisement. Our organization is reviewing it as we speak, and we are doing in-depth staff reviews of the findings. We also have an extended public comment period, which will end on March 19th. Right. And in this, and it's really designed to give people a full chance to comment on this and to get, you know, their suggestions in on where we need to go with this plan. And so the agency has really sought to conduct as open a public process as possible and to really give the region a chance to comment on this. And if we didn't get it right on some things, we want to listen to people, and our focus is to really get this right for Southeast Alaska. I did just want to reflect on the public process. AEA has worked with Southeast Conference over the last some 16 months when we conducted this process, and they've been instrumental in assisting in getting the meetings together. And I want to just give my personal thanks to Mr. Robert Venables, who's the energy coordinator for the Southeast Conference. With that, I would like to introduce Mr. Harper, and Mr. Chairman, with your concurrence, turn the cudgel over to Mr. Harper.
Absolutely. And again, if you could state your name and affiliation for the record.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Thank you. My name is Kevin Harper. I'm a project director at Black & Veatch. Black & Veatch is an international engineering consulting firm that was hired by the Energy Authority to conduct this study. And as Mr. Strandberg said, my role today is to kind of give you an overview of kind of our findings and recommendations and what drives those, to try to give you a better sense of from our perspective, you know, the realities in the Southeast as you make decisions in terms of meeting the energy needs, you know, of the region. As both Ms. Goad and Ms. Strandberg mentioned, you know, there was an extensive public participation process, and I'd like to just acknowledge that from the Black Veatch perspective. We found that whole process to be extremely important. And the reason is that, you know, the conducting of integrated resource plans is something that I've been involved in, probably 10 or 15 of them in my life, and fellow team members, similar numbers, if not more. And I can honestly say that the conducting of this, completing of this study was in many ways perhaps the most challenging one. And the reason why it was so challenging is because of the very unique nature of Southeast Alaska. And part of my comments will talk about what some of those unique elements are and what that meant in terms of the analysis, because it's very fundamental to many of our recommendations. So my job is to kind of give you an overview. I think there's two general comments I'd like to just leave with you before I dive into the presentation. And the first is, you know, the role of an integrated resource plan is to help set a direction. It's what, you know, I often refer to as a directional plan. The level of granularity is such that you can't go in and decide to put a specific type of piece of equipment into a plant on a particular site in a given time. It's more of a directional plan. And related to that, I think the way I would characterize what we've put forward in the document, and these are words that came from one of the members of the advisory group, is that it is a conservative but radical plan. And I'd like to explain that for a second, because I think that's important. The word conservative is intended to mean that as we went through and looked at the various projects, as we made decisions about the analysis, what the loads are going to be and so forth, we try to be conservative from an analytical perspective. The word radical is meant to indicate, I think, that the conclusions and the recommendations are in many ways very different than what I think a lot of people had in their mind when we started the project in terms of how the region ought to move forward. And I would suggest that that radical part of the recommendations, if you will, is perhaps part of the reason why there is an overflow of people in the room. The conclusions we come up with, or came up with, are admittedly conclusions that are challenging for the region to get their hands around so that you can make a decision as a region as to which path you want to go forward. And I think that the nature of the comments we've received so far and the comments that we expect to receive will reflect that in terms of the various people, you know, in interest in the region coming to grips and looking at the report and looking at the analysis and the conclusions. So with that, I'll move forward and just talk about some of our key findings and some of the key drivers. As you know, the Southeast Alaska region is a relatively small region. Kind of put that in perspective. From an electric load perspective, the region is about one-fifth the size of the rail belt. And if you compared the rail belt to Canada or the lower 48, all six utilities together in the rail belt would be considered a small utility. So that is a very fundamental aspect of the region, which drives to a large degree much of our results, is the size of the loads in the region are very small. Second is obviously, as you know very well, you know, the economic realities and the population trends in the region are a challenge because they don't help with the fundamental scale problem that I just mentioned.
Representative Wilson?
Do you mind if I ask some questions?
Maybe if you could ask, go ahead and ask, and then maybe if we could just hold off just so we can get through it. I know we have a lot of people and a lot of testimony, but go ahead and ask your question.
One of the things that I'm wondering about is the population trends, and I know the trend in the last 10 years has been that in Southeast it's gone down, but we want to do things that will turn that around, and if I... And so you just looked at it as if it continued down, right? You didn't take into effect that there would be things done to try to turn that population trend around?
Mr. Chair, if I may, through in our analysis, we looked at three specific load forecasts for each of the communities, a high, base, and low. The base forecast is built in large degree on recent trends, as reflected in the forecast developed by the state in terms of population growth. The high case represents a much greater growth in load, about two-thirds of a growth, higher growth in load over a 50-year period. So when we did the analysis, we had both high, base, and low, and the high reflects a growth in population within the region.
Follow up.
So, in plain, easy to understand English, not using high and low and all that. Just tell me, what did you look at it with the population trend continuing down, or did you put some caveats in there in case it came up? This is what would happen.
Well, again, our when we looked at the high case, that is the caveat. That is what happens if the growth of the region goes up, as opposed to, you know, based on the trends that are in the most recent state forecast. So we look at both cases, continuing trend and increased population.
Okay. And then I guess just as you go along, if you would tell us, okay, this is what we looked at when we said low trend, and this is what happened when we said high trend. If you would bring that out each time, I'd appreciate it.
So last point on this slide that I'd like
to... I'm sorry, and Representative Munoz is on that point.
On this point, and then I'll save my questions till the end. In your high load forecast, did you take into account mining, current and projected mining activity?
Representative, through the chair, the high load forecast that we developed assumes growth in load that could be as a result of either growth in population, economic development loads, or electric vehicles. Okay, and the growth is relative to the base case or reference case, represents about two-thirds more load out over time than what's in the reference case. So there's a significant difference between the high and the reference case. We don't talk about what trends might cause that growth in load. But we just indicate that there are things, whether it's growth in population, economic development loads like mines and small mines, electric vehicles that cause this growth. Now, the one thing that's not directly addressed is what happens if a major mine was to come into the region, and that arguably would be outside of our high load forecast. But in what we looked at, we didn't think that it was a prudent thing to include speculative potential loads like a large mine that would be outside of our high load forecast.
Just one follow-up, if I will, and then I'll wait. What about the Kensington mine? Did you include that in your forecasting?
That
operational mine.
Yeah, when we looked at the various mines in the region, it was in that list. And that load could be served and still be within our high load case load forecast. Kensington is such that it has several close resources that could serve that mine, and there are a couple proposals underway in terms of entities like AP&T stepping up and trying to serve that mine, which would not require a regional solution to that problem. That's a localized load that has localized generation that could serve that load.
And just for the audience, so you're aware of just kind of what we're going to do here, we'll have committee questions right after the presentation. I think it looks like you've got about 15 slides, so we'll let you get through that. And then after that, we'll be taking public testimony. And I think we've got about 20 people that want to testify here, maybe two online so far. And so, I'm certainly willing to stay longer just so that we can get this all on the record if we go past five. So anyway, please proceed with your testimony.
I'll try to be respectful of the desire of others to talk. The last point I'd like to make on this slide is the fact that anywhere from 60 to 75% of monthly energy bills are related to space heating. I think it's very easy to think of the Integrated Resource Plan as an electric-only plan, but it is, in fact, aimed at addressing both the high cost of electricity as well as the high cost of space heating. And we'll get into those recommendations here in a little bit. There are a number of uncertainties. You have uncertainties in terms of loads. The size of your load is such that if a big mine hit, that would be a major event. Okay, so there are uncertainties about loads. There are uncertainties with regards to your resources, and we'll talk about some of the uncertainties related to hydro in a minute because that's very important. And from our perspective, those uncertainties lead to the need to look at multiple options and basically develop a diverse portfolio of resources moving forward. In our view, that's the most prudent way of moving forward in an environment of great uncertainty. Now, this slide shows how, from an analytical perspective, we broke the region up into eight subregions. Now, when we first came up with this approach very early in the project, it was simply to facilitate the modeling that we had to do to look at the economics of the potential transmission segments that would actually connect these different subregions. So we started out from an analytical perspective coming up with this approach. But as you see on the right-hand side of the box there, as you know, one of the unique things about the region is the very large range in electric costs that are paid, going from 9 cents to above 60 cents. I can't think of any other place in North America where you have that disparity in terms of cost. And so while we did this initially from an analytical perspective to look at the transmission segments, it became increasingly important through the course of the study, because what we ended up concluding halfway through was that there was no silver bullet that would solve all of the problems for the region. And so what we present in the report is really kind of a roadmap for each of the sub-regions that you see up on the screen. Some other key issues. The region as a whole could use more storage hydro. And storage hydro has more value to the region than run or the river. Doesn't mean run or river doesn't have value, but storage has more value. And that's essentially to better match when you can generate the power to meet the loads that you need it. Space heating conversions are a real issue. And here I'm referring to conversions from fuel oil to electricity. As you know, there's been a recent trend where a lot of folks, both at the residential level as well as commercial and schools, have been converting to electric space heating. What that has done is that has led to the using up of what used to be excess hydro capacity. And the question for the region to really decide is, what is the highest value use of the hydro resource? And as you know, probably one of our biggest recommendations is to induce people to consider moving to biomass space heating as opposed to electric. And that's really what this bullet is aimed at. So let me talk a little bit about the limitations associated with the information available on hydro projects. At the bottom there, you see that we looked at about 300 different hydro projects that had been identified over time. We went through a screening process, and through that screening process, about 24 projects were identified and put on the screened list. But when you look at that list of 24, you see that the majority of the projects have not been developed sufficiently for us to be able to tell you within a reasonable range what the cost of power is. Many of these projects have cost of capital costs that would be plus or minus 30 or 50%, and their output estimates are plus or minus 50%. And if you take the plus or minus 50% on both of those, you end up with a cost of power range that's an order of magnitude. And this was a very fundamental problem we had in completing our analysis and not being able to take those 24 projects and say these projects ought to go forward, because the quality of the information simply is not there to make that definitive decision. So one of our key recommendations is over the next couple of 3 years, studies be done to get the quality of the information on those projects up to a point where you can make that decision as a region to decide which projects really should go forward. So what that led to is a need to look at hydro in a generic way. So we use some generic costs and output for hydro in the various subregions in order to do our analysis. And we essentially came up with, you know, two cases to compare to the status quo. First was what we called an optimal hydro transmission case. This was, you take what's currently in place, you add what we refer to as committed resources, which I'll explain in a minute, but those are hydro and transmission projects in the near term. And then you add more hydro and transmission going forward. So that was one integrated case. The second is where we focused initially on demand-side management, energy efficiency, biomass conversions, and then look at hydro down the road, you know, further in the future time frame. So those are the two cases that we looked and compared to the status quo in terms of continuing down the path that we're currently on in terms of resources. So that led to a recommendation of approaching the future in two phases. And the first phase is the first 4 years, 4 to 5 years, And I want to talk a little bit about the specific resources included then. First is the committed resources. Now, what I want to talk about a little bit on committed resources, these are projects currently underway or under development, many of which have already received state funding or in the process of being considered for additional funding, and were projects that the advisory group passed by resolution as projects that they felt should go forward. So we called those committed resources. What that means from an analytical perspective is we assumed these projects would go forward. And so all of our analysis was in addition to these projects. And as you can see on the slide, you basically have five hydro projects, many of which I'm sure you're familiar with, and two specific transmission expansion projects that have been discussed, you know, within the region. Okay, so first part of phase one is to go forward with these committed resources. The second part of phase one is, as a region, to embark upon a targeted and significant energy efficiency program, as well as a significant program aimed at assisting residents and businesses to convert from fuel oil space heating to biomass space heating. Okay. The other part of phase one, there's two other key parts, and that is that there would be monies spent to do the types of studies that I mentioned earlier necessary to look at the hydro projects as well as other renewable projects, and get the quality of the information to a point where you can make rational decisions on. And then the last aspect of phase one is, once you've got that, then redo the integrated resource plan in about 4 years, which is a common practice. Now, where you will be as a region 4 years from now is you will have a much better idea of what those hydro projects will look like and which ones are the best ones to go forward. You'll have a better sense of which economic development loads might actually come through. And you'll have a much better sense of whether the region can stand up a type of regional program that would result in the types of energy efficiency and biomass conversions that we have in our plan. And we would suggest to you that that puts you in a position 4 years hence, after you've gone forward with committed resources in the near term in these studies, to make the long-term decisions that would be in best interest, you know, of the region. And then phase two is just a continuation where you do the study, and whatever the study comes out of, whatever comes out of the study in terms of projects moving forward, that's what you would develop. So a couple other things related to transmission, which we haven't really talked about. As I'm sure each of you know, the concept of the Southeast Intertie has been talked about for many years. There have been a number of studies that have been done. We used those studies. We looked at them. We did some revision of cost estimates to reflect current costs. We added a couple potential transmission segments that had not been looked at before, and we did our own analysis of that. Of the various transmission segments that have been talked about. Two key issues with regards to transmission in the region. Number one is it is expensive to build transmission in Southeast Alaska because of the terrain and distances. And then second is you come back to that small loads in the region. So you got high cost, small loads. Transmission is a very fixed cost oriented investment, and it's like an airplane. You know, if you fill up the seats, the costs are lower per unit cost, but if you don't, they're much higher. So when we looked at transmission, we looked at two specific cases. One is the economic case, and the second is the public benefit case. In the economic case, we assumed that the utilities and their customers would pay for all of the capital costs, all of the O&M and replacement costs associated with the lines. And we use this as a screen. And essentially what we looked at was, what is the per unit cost of transmitting power over these segments relative to the cost of diesel to generate electricity? Now, be real clear there. When we looked at the per unit transmission cost, that does not include any cost of power. So it's just purely the cost of transmission relative to the cost of diesel generation, and that's, you know, the, is kind of, you know, the proxy is, or, you know, what is the existing situation. In the public benefit case, what we assumed is that the state would pay for the capital cost up front, and then the ratepayer, the utilities and their customers would pay for the O&M and replacement cost. Now, as you see in the bottom, there's two points I'd like to make. Number one is, of all of the transmission segments we looked at, there was not one of them that had a lower unit transmission cost that was less than the existing cost of diesel. And then the second is that even if you assume the state pays for all the capital, the benefit-cost ratios of those segments ranged anywhere from 0.1 to 0.32. Now, what that means is that for every dollar, if you just use the 0.32 example, which is the best, for every dollar that the state invests, the region would receive only 32 cents benefit. Now, fundamentally, that has to do with size. You simply aren't large enough to build a lot of transmission and move enough power to get the unit costs down to an economic level. Now, we also looked at the AKBC intertie, which has been discussed. I mean, we looked at both an import and export case. And essentially, our findings, our screening analysis shows that based upon current conditions, where we looked at export and import prices in Canada and in the lower 48, that from an economic standpoint, the AKBC line did not make sense moving forward. Now, that is based upon current conditions. Now, we looked at market prices. In the export case, we based it on a market price that was for a 20-year contract that has built into a projections about what market prices might look like. But if you know about energy market prices, as I know you do, they vary significantly. So I can't say to you that within the next 50 years it won't make sense to reconsider the AKBC line. But based on what is known today, our conclusion is it does not make sense to go forward with that. So next couple of slides, just talk a little bit about, kind of give you a perspective of investments. This slide shows the investment by category. So you've got up here two pictures. The one on the left is over the next 3 years, and then the one on the right is over the 50-year period. And you see the split in terms of investment for the region as a whole by type of resource. So you have committed resources, additional hydro, replacement of existing diesel facilities, energy efficiency, and biomass. Over the next 3 years, our projection is total investment required, you know, if you went forward with the resource plan that we put forward, would require $346 million in investment, and over the 50-year period, it's about $2 billion. Now, the one thing I'd like to note from this slide is really highlighted in the bottom, and that is that there are some, I think, that would characterize this plan as being a no-hydro plan. And I'd like to point out that it really isn't.
It is not.
When you look at the committed resources, those five projects, you see a total of about 19 megawatts. If you look at the other hydro that was also included in our, what kind of is our recommended resource portfolio, there's another 50 megawatts. So that's roughly 70 megawatts. Now, to put that in perspective, the total load of the region is less than 200 megawatts. So there's over 30-plus percent of the existing load that's represented here, plus all of the existing hydro that's in place. So the way I would characterize the plan is that in the near term, you go forward with the committed resources, which do include hydro. You do demand-side management, energy efficiency, you focus on biomass conversions, and you do the studies to determine which project should be the next round of investments, hydro and otherwise. Now, this slide just shows kind of a breakdown by subregion, so you get a sense of, you know, kind of how this goes across the region as well. And I'll take a minute on this slide. What this slide shows is the savings from our recommended portfolio of projects relative to the status quo, which again would be you know, just continuation of the reliance on diesel and fuel oil to a large degree. And what we show in terms of the dollar figures there, those are 50-year cumulative net present worth savings figures, okay? So what I'd like to suggest we do is focus on the percentages, because I think that's what's most important. So what I show at the bottom there, the three numbers going across for the two bullets. The first is the percentage savings in electric bills. The second is the percentage saving in space heating bills. And the third is total. The first line is our recommended portfolio relative to the status quo case. And the second line shows the relative savings compared to a case where you just build hydro and transmission. Okay. And what you see is basically we put forward a portfolio that shows savings in the 40 to 46% level for electric and space heating that essentially goes across pretty much each of the subregions. Certainly the space heating savings are pretty consistent across the subregions. And when you compare our recommended to the, well, when you look at the you know, just build more hydro case, you see the electric savings are roughly or less than half of what's in our recommended. Okay. So what we're trying to say is this. You go down the path along the lines of what we've recommended, you will save somewhere north of 40% in people's energy bills on a monthly basis. Residents, businesses. Okay? And if you go down that path, you will save more money than if you try to build simply hydro and transmission to meet your electric needs. Okay? Additionally, you go down our path in terms of energy efficiency and biomass, you will help to save the existing hydro resources and use future hydro resources for the highest value use of hydro, which our view is not residential heating. You know, you can use power to turn motors, which create jobs. And what our suggestion is that that's the way you go in terms of how you use hydro, is to really look at the highest value use of that resource, because you have other options which actually are more cost effective in terms of meeting some of your other needs for electricity and space heating. We also have in the recommendation in our study some other recommendations which we think are important and are shown up here, and I won't go through this in any detail, but I'll just mention there's a couple things that really need to do. One is, I think, reflective of the interest shown in this hearing, and I think some of the comments you'll hear, there are legitimately different views on whether this path is the right path or not. And I think it is such a complex issue that there's got to be time spent helping the public to understand the points, and so that you can have the kind of dialogue you need to have as a region to make these decisions. The other point I'll make, and you'll see in several of these line items, are related to demand side management and biomass. If you're going to go down this path, my only caution is that you do it in a very serious way and look at approaching it from a regional perspective. You know, there is a lot of experience both elsewhere in the country and elsewhere in the world in terms of energy efficiency as well as conversions to biomass. Okay, so you don't have to reinvent the wheel, but if you approach it as a region and you do it in a substantive way, you're going to have much more success than if it's left up to each community or each utility to do it. And that's embedded in our recommendations here. And then the final thing I'll just mention, two more things I'll just mention, is we have in here significant dollars recommended for the study related to the hydro projects, as I mentioned earlier, as well as other renewable projects, again, to get the information up to an appropriate level. And then finally, we have recommendations in the study that are aimed at trying to make the region more conducive to private interest coming in and developing power projects. And those are related to opening up the transmission system for use by others, as well as coming up with kind of standard power purchase contracts that can be used as starting points for negotiations. So let me just real quickly just close things off, just kind of repeat some things I said to try to what I would consider to be the major takeaways. Again, first, the Southeast region is very small in loads, and that is just a fundamental reality that you have to deal with. Second is that, you know, somewhere around two-thirds of the monthly bills paid for energy are for space heating. Okay, electricity is not the only issue, as you know. It is, you know, moving forward, you need to address both electric and space heating issues. The disparity in costs, you know, some parts of the region are paying 9 cents of kilowatt hour for electricity, some are 60 cents or above. As I mentioned, you know, we looked at 300 hydro projects, 24 passed the screen for further consideration, but the majority of those projects have not been developed far enough yet in order to look at a rational economic evaluation of one project versus another. As I mentioned, when we looked at the cost of transmission for the various segments relative to diesel, none of them were less expensive. And the benefit cost ratios, even if you assume the state pays for the upfront cost of the transmission, are anywhere from 0.1 to 0.3. Again, you spend a dollar, the region gets no more than 32 cents worth of benefit. Hydro, this is not a no hydro case. As I mentioned, you have roughly, you know, almost 70 megawatts in a region that has less than 200 megawatts total load. And this is new hydro in addition to existing hydro. And then finally, the level of savings, which from our perspective, if you go down a path that shows 40% savings in terms of monthly energy costs, that will do a significant amount in terms of addressing your population issue, in terms of keeping people here. It will do a lot in terms of improving your economic situation. And from our perspective, it sets a foundation upon which you can, you know, build other economic development efforts in terms of moving forward. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll stop and take any questions.
Great. Very much appreciate your coming and giving the presentation here. I'd like to kind of, again, the procedure, open it up to committee questions here. And I would like to recognize Representative Bill Thomas has been with us for quite some time now, and so thank you for coming. So open it up to committee questions here, and then once we're through with that, we do have about 25 people both in the room and online here, and we're going to try and limit that to about 3 minutes a person for testimony, which will take at least probably about an hour and 15 minutes. I think we've got the room till 5, but I don't think anybody is in the room afterwards, and so like I say, I'm happy, and anyone else who's welcome to wants to stay is welcome to stay, and we'll make sure that we give everybody a chance to you know, make your voices heard. So with that, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering, when you were looking at the long-range cost of the hydro, how many year lifespan were you looking at for these hydro projects? 50 years, 30 years, 100 years?
So, Representative Peterson, through the chair, our economic analysis, you know, essentially was built on a 50-year time frame. And hydro, when we looked at hydro, we extended that out in terms of our analysis. But what happens in economic, you know, when you go out 50 years and you start discounting back to present value, you know, there really isn't much difference when you get that far out. But it did it is a big difference between 50 years and 20 years. And so we reflect that in our analysis.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Next up, we have Representative Pruitt. Co-Chair Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. A couple questions, if you could just help me fill in some of the gaps. I know you stated that the current load is 20% of the rail belts. What is the current use in electricity?
To the chair, in terms of megawatts or megawatt hours?
Megawatt, yeah.
Megawatts is about 170 megawatts.
And if, let's say, I'm not, I'll just ask, if we were to utilize electricity for space heating, which you said some people are moving, let's say that we just theoretically put the majority of the people on that, what would that do to the increase of that load? So 170 megawatts now, what would it be if we had space heating also included in that?
To be honest, I don't know the number off the top of my head. It would probably be in the neighborhood of about 2 to 3 times what the current loads are.
Okay. Another thing that I wanted to ask was, when you were talking about the cost-benefit ratio of transmission line, and then you touched on the Alaska BC. Question that I have is do we have? You mentioned there were 300 different hydro projects, of which 24 that you found. Is an issue generation, or is the issue just that it's so spread out? And so, I mean, do we have multiple resources, hydro, whatever it needs to be, that we could access and tie in at some? And I'm thinking broad, theoretical. I mean, don't look at it in the sense of, well, it doesn't make sense. I'm just kind of trying to get an understanding of what we have in the area.
If you looked at the total megawatts of the 24 hydro projects that, you know, passed our initial screen, I think it is around 300 megawatts. So you have enough hydro. The question, in our view, is whether you have enough cost-effective hydro.
Right.
That's the fundamental. Now, the other problem you have is getting that hydropower to where the loads are.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, when you connect hydro to a nearby load center, those transmission costs, you know, are much less and generally, you know, probably can be supported. But it's when you try to, you know, build a network that connects all of the region that you get loaded down with so many fixed costs that it just doesn't work out economically.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chairman, one last question that I want to was there a thought? Last year we came to the understanding that when the state, I think your analysis took into account that the state would provide for paying for the transmission lines at this point, and then eventually the utilities would pay for the operation, maintenance, and the replacement. Now, I think what we came to the conclusion and understanding of last year, and I think Representative Wilson and I talked about this, we were surprised, is that I believe that currently the RTA does not allow a utility to basically save for the replacement. Was that any way included in the analysis that could potentially bring down the cost initially to the customer because they're not saving? And I'm just throwing numbers out, so they're not saving a penny per kilowatt for future replacement, and the expectation that the state would eventually do that was that something that was considered in there?
What we considered was if you look at what the annual costs are of general O&M and repair and replacement, we made an estimate of that. And we made the assumption in the public benefit case that the local utility and their customers would pay for those costs. What we did not look at was what are some of the alternative kind of rate structures that you can put in place to deal with, you know, some of these issues. Now, we do have a section that talks about some of the general approaches that you can take. You know, at hydro, the problem you've got is you've got a high upfront cost, right? And those have to be amortized over time. So we address it in a generic way. But because our near-term implementation plan is really focused on demand-side management and biomass and the committed resources, which to a large degree have already been financed, there was not a need to do a more detailed assessment of what financing model might make sense. But it will be an important issue down the road when you start making long-term decisions on hydro projects as to how you might want to build the rate structure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll allow others to ask questions.
Thank you. I think Representative Sadler, do you have a question? No questions. Okay. Are there further questions of the committee? Representative Munoz.
Thank you. What is the cost that we have into this project so far, and what would Phase 2 cost the state?
Let me, if I may, have Mr. Strandberg answer that, because he can give you the fuller picture of what the total cost of the project is. Then I can answer the second part.
Representative Munoz, through the chair, the current project budget is $1 million. We've spent something just over $900,000. The major components of that were the consultant contract. There was relatively extensive travel costs and per diem costs for the advisory work group. I do not have a number as to what Phase 2 would cost. We're formulating those thoughts right now and putting together potential figures on what that might cost, but I just can't answer that right now.
Okay, I have a couple more questions.
Follow-up?
Let's see. Had we not already supported the projects that you identify, the hydro projects, would you have recommended moving forward independently on those projects? I mean, we've already committed to those projects.
I didn't hear part of the question. Is the question about the committed resources, the hydro projects, in terms of evaluation? We did not look at those specifically because they were, you know, deemed to be projects that ought to go forward. So we didn't do a detailed economic analysis of those projects, similar to the other resources that we looked at.
Okay. And what was the market price you used to evaluate the energy cost for discounting the AKDC project?
So in the case of the exporting of power, what we did was we looked at different market prices, kind of starting in Canada, going down to California. In our view, the most positive metric contract price that was in place is for California, which has the nation's, you know, most aggressive renewable standard. It is a state that has contracts in place for renewable power, which are significantly above what the current market prices are in up and down the coast. So we used that price in California, which is standard, is set by regulatory statute, adjusted over time. And in our view, getting that power over 20 years, and they have a 20-year contract that you can sign up for at a specific price. But if you get that price for 20 years on a base load where you're selling the power all the time, that was probably as good of a deal as you could get. Now, there may be cases where you could sell the power on a spot market, and there are times when you would make more money, but you wouldn't be selling it all the time. And that is a call. The scope of our analysis was not to go in and do the type of detailed market assessment necessary to really decide exactly how you would want to sell it in the marketplace. But I would suggest that what we put forward is a fairly optimistic case in terms of what's sellable in the market. Then you have to assume that you've got firm transmission from here all the way down to California, and you have to pay for the cost of moving that power, and you have to pay for the losses. Okay, so there's a lot of issues associated with that, but we considered that at a screening level based on the information available today.
I'm sorry, what was the market price that you used to discount the
that particular project?
It was, I believe, I don't know that number off the top of my head. I'm sorry. It's in the report. I just don't remember off the top of my head.
I have other questions, but they'll come. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Sadler. And
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I take my heart in hand here. Sir, I have a lot of respect for Black & Veatch, and you're a good consultant. You know, I've obviously done a lot of analysis here. I confess I'm a bit at sea here, where there's a lot of analysis of the situation, but I'm not quite sure what the plan is. And so I'm going to ask, to some degree, for people, my apologies to everybody here, but the person from Anchorage or Fairbanks watching this that doesn't know the situation in the Southeast, and to some degree for me, what exactly is the plan that we're analyzing and elements of it? Could you put it in terms that my grandmother, you know, is going to understand back in Anchorage? All of you does live in Anchorage.
Okay. In the near term, it would be to go forward with the completion of 5 hydro projects and 2 transmission projects that have been looked at and discussed in the region. It would embark upon a substantive or significant energy efficiency program at residential and commercial and it, you know, schools and so forth, to help lower the use of energy and in many cases improve the quality of life in those communities where you have energy efficiency that's occurring because people turn off lights because they can't afford it. This would allow you to keep the lights on and still afford the rates. And then embark upon an aggressive program to convert fuel oil space heating equipment to biomass, largely pellets, which would generate significant savings on the space heating side. Then do a number of studies related to potential hydro projects to determine which ones would be the best projects to move forward, you know, in the next round of construction. And not only hydro, but also other renewable projects. So that is how I would characterize the plan.
I got a feedback to you. So build 5 hydro dams that have been identified or launched upon, 2 transmission line projects, build those. Start a conservation program in schools and public buildings. Start converting heating from fuel oil to pellets to biomass, and study other potential hydro. That puts some hard edges on it for me. That helps me out. Thanks.
Next up, we have Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going back to your statement regarding Kensington, and it's considered localized, not considered of the integrated resource plan. And was there other mines that were considered as being its own localized solution and not being part of the integrated plan that we should consider?
So, in Representative Tuck, through the chair, we looked in the report. We have a list of about 12-14 different potential mines that are being looked at. Some of them are lend themselves to a localized solution because they've got nearby hydro or nearby renewable resource that can meet their needs. Others could be met through, you know, an integrated transmission network. What we did was we knew that there was a need to look at what happens if the load in the region is significantly higher than it is now. And we felt it was more important to look at that question than look at exactly how you might get there. So when we came up with this high case load forecast, you know, we talked about the fact that you could get there through mines, you could get there through population growth, you could get there through electric vehicles. But the important thing is what would happen if you get there. And what we mean by getting there is that, the high forecast is about 65% higher than the base forecast in terms of load. Okay, and so we looked at both cases in terms of our analysis. Okay, so most of the mines that are looked at that are in the region either would be a localized solution or would be within that band of 65% above, you know, the base case in terms of load forecast.
Okay, Mr. Chair,
follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And was the 12-14 mines, is that strictly Alaskan mines, or is that included some Canadian mines? Because I know on serving on the Economic Development, Trade, and Tourism Committee, we've had the Canadian consulate do some presentations with us, really wanting to start receiving power from Alaska, if all possible. And so I'm just trying to figure out, because I know that those are probably localized solutions, and you probably look, and I know you looked at the 50 years and look at the high load, but there's almost like a third component that we need to look at, and that's trying to hopefully blend this integrated plan, not just the integrated transmission, but looking at the plan and being able to look at it as a whole with the individuals that are considered.
Representative Tuck, through the to the chair, a couple of comments. The answer your question specifically, the mines that we consider and discuss in the report are Alaska mines. But the other thing I'll note is not only is it difficult to predict what prices in the competitive energy market will be going forward, it's also difficult to predict what the viewpoint of Canadians will be on importing and exporting power. And they have changed over time. They have new administration right now. They are less interested from what they told Mr. Strandberg and Mr. Venables a couple of weeks ago. They appear to be less interested in the connection to Alaska. That could change next month. I mean, that is an issue that, you know, is another uncertainty associated with, you know, mines, is that, you know, the politics in Canada in terms of supporting the connection with Alaska.
I didn't follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up?
It sounds like they must have changed their mind last week, because I think last week they presented to us on the desire to purchase power through us. But if they go back and forth that much, then maybe there is a reason to consider the changes. But going back to also looking at, so when you, I'm just trying to understand that when you did your 50-year, and I'm looking at the 50-year plan, that when you looked at certain mines that may be able to get their own hydro and maybe their own standalone systems, was that part of the integrated plan, or that was excluded from consideration from the integrated plan?
Those would be outside of an integrated plan in terms of the solution there, yeah.
And then follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
And when looking at, so was there any looking at possibly including their individual solutions to a toll grid with all the other considerations of the integrated plan?
Yeah. So again, the analysis was not specific to individual mines. And we tried to look at what happens if the load in the region is significantly greater than it is today. Because trying to predict how the loads are going to grow, whether you're talking about mines, which you're, you know, they tend to be large per unit, per project, but they're speculative in terms of which projects will be developed and how long they'll be developed. You could ask people with different views on the prospects of electric vehicles in the region. You can certainly get different perspectives on population trends in the region. Okay. So what we tried to do was focus on what happens if the load is significantly greater than it is today in terms of how you meet your energy needs, as opposed to trying to predict, you know, with a lower level of granularity or greater detail of granularity than we could do in terms of the various elements that might get you there. So our mine analysis, generally speaking, our views, you know, much of the potential mines that are out there would fall within the range of the high forecast.
Okay. And then again, Mr. Chair, thank you. Actually, it's a new question. On the biomass, on the pellets, I heard you mention pellets. Are we looking at making pellet plants in Southeast Alaska? And how did you determine the cost of what it would take to convert things to pellets and actually burn off of pellets?
Through the chair, what we used in our economic analysis is the assumption that the pellets would come from Canada or the lower 48. We used cost estimates from Sea Alaska based on their experience in moving pellets up, as well as other, you know, we had a couple other estimates that we, you know, come up with a number. We used that, if you remember what I said at the very beginning in terms of conservative, you know, but radical, to us that's a conservative assumption. because if you convert at anywhere near the level we're talking about, you are going to be able to economically justify having plants up here to create the pellets. And that will be less expensive than importing from the lower 48 or Canada. So from our perspective, the conservative approach was for economic analysis to assume that the pellets would come, you know, from outside of the region because it would cost more. And that's what we base our analysis on.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to make a comment that it would have been nice to have some sort of, I should have brought a map with me. I didn't think about bringing a map, but it would have been kind of nice to have a map to oversee some of that. But thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pruitt and then Sadler.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask about that as well, the biomass. And so two more questions really kind of related to that is, you know, Southeast has put their trust in biomass before, and the federal government screwed them. How confident are we we're about to talk about a significant possible change over here, and we're going to put our reliance on something that we don't have necessarily a global market for. It's really kind of a niche market here. We're talking about something that is not utilized all over. And are we confident that we won't get shut down if we try to convert everyone over and produce those pellets here in Alaska, that we'll still have a supply of them from the lower 48? I mean, how confident are we that this is going to continue? Because I would hate for the federal government to shut us down again after we've gotten everyone converted over to this new system.
Representative, through the chair, each resource option or technology, you know, that you consider has their own set of risks associated with it. And clearly biomass, you know, conversions are no different. And, you know, in our view, those are certainly issues that you would want to explore and make sure you were comfortable with before you made really large, you know, investments. Now, what we assume, just to kind of put it in context, is we assume that 80% of the customers out there, you know, space, you know, residential houses, for example, that 80% of them would convert to biomass over a 10-year period. Okay. Now, from our perspective, a rational approach is you might do some pilot programs to test. I don't think you have to test the technology, but I think you have to test people's willingness, the acceptability of the technology. I think it also gives you time to get a better understanding of the supply chain logistics that would be involved. And just as you would go forward with any new technology, if you don't bet the house, you know, on one investment, you do it over time and you can spread it out over time and determine whether you can do that. I would suggest that you have some real issues in terms of, as a region, whether you can deliver the number of homes to convert, because you got to get people to convert. And I know I don't do what's necessarily the most economically rational thing to do all the time, but you also have the infrastructure. You know, and you got to build that within a region, because again, if you do it community by community, utility by utility, you're not going to get there. And I think those are some real challenges that are probably, you know, bigger ones than, you know, some of the other, you know, challenges that people have mentioned. So,
and follow up. I appreciate that answer. One and the second one, kind of related, similar to that, would be, let's say we convert a community over, we're successful. And I apologize for my ignorance on how clean burning the biomass would be, but would we, in Fairbanks, of course, they're a lot colder, so they burn probably quite a bit more than what we'd see here. Is there potential that particulate in the air would become a problem, EPA, that would have issues with this? And again, it goes back to then having a community on a certain method of being able to generate energy and having to shut them down or having to penalize them in some manner.
Representative, through the chair, certainly, you know, biomass, like any other you know, burnt fuel, has emissions and so forth. And you know, from our perspective, one way of looking at that is, you know, what are you replacing, right? Is it the cleanest option out there? No, there's no question about that. There are other, you know. But in our view, it is a significant improvement over the current situation in terms of emissions, and then economically, it's you know, very compelling from our perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Did you have a...
Yes, sir. Sir, on page 5, I'm going to ask you a question, too, about the two integrated cases. And if I understand the structure of your slides, you're saying that these two different options, one which would optimize the use of hydro and transmission, you know, building a couple of big hydro plants and sending it elsewhere, and the second is to optimize biomass and other renewables. And is that, am I reading this slide correctly?
Yes. Let me go.
Now, I have to ask you to give me some hard edges on DSM-EE, terms I'm not familiar with.
Energy efficiency.
Energy efficiency, okay. And DSM?
Okay, so DSM is demand-side management.
Which is?
It is similar to, well, it is used commonly in a way similar to energy efficiency. So some people think of it as demand-side management. Some of it is energy efficiency. Technically, demand-side management is anything you do on the demand to help manage it. Okay. So you can have high-efficiency dishwashers, for example. You could have, you know, replace your lighting. You could do insulation. Okay.
On-demand hot water heater.
Right. Yeah. So those are kind of similar, common options that are used to reduce energy and manage demand, if you will. Okay. So that's those are two terms that are commonly used interchangeably.
Okay. And so you're comparing these two, and you say two integrated cases. What do you mean? What is integrated in this context?
So. Usually when you do these studies and you have good data on all of the resource options, you can throw all of the options into the model, the black box, and out comes the most economic. Okay? The fundamental issue we had here, if you go back to what I said earlier about the quality of the information on the potential hydro, is that we could have thrown in the data we had on those 24 hydro projects, and we could have let the model, you know, pick those projects. But because of the quality of the data, if you remember, the resulting cost of power is an order of magnitude difference there. You know, if you do the cost of, you know, plus or minus 50% on capital costs and plus or minus 50% on energy. So what is the value of the output? So that was a fundamental decision. So once we went to that, we had to go to generic hydro. And it was once we did that, then you couldn't do a definitive apples-to-apples comparison of all of the resources because you had some real resources and you had some generic resources. So we came up with these two cases. One was we took existing resources, we included the committed resources, and then we told the model, just add more hydro and transmission, and basically it just adds hydro. Okay, because none of the transmission lines pass the economics. So that is, if you think about it, the only option you had was to build more hydro. Here's what it might look like. Then the second case is where we said, okay, let's convert 80% of the houses to biomass. Let's embark upon an aggressive energy efficiency program in the near term. And then over the longer term, let's look at adding more hydro or other renewables. And so that's what that second case is, okay? So in both cases, we put constraints around what the model had to pick from, and we allowed it to go out over time, and then we did the comparison about what those two cases look like. So I hope that
helps. Good.
What I would like to do now, unless there's any real burning desire to answer or ask a question right now of the committee, and we can always submit those as a committee, you know, if there are more questions later. But I really would like to give the public an opportunity to come up and present. So at this time, we'll be taking public comments on the Southeast Alaska Integrated Resource Plan. As the plan is still in public comment period, today's comments will be forwarded to the project director. Again, we've got about 25 people. I'd like to ask that folks maybe try and limit that to 3 minutes. We also, I think what we're going to do is we'll start with the folks here in the audience first, and then we'll go to folks on the line there. I think we've probably got about four or five people on the phone. So with that, we're going to try and take this in the order that folks signed up here. And we have first Bill Lady. Bill, are you here? Thank you, Bill. And again, just standard operating procedures. If you could identify yourself and state your affiliation and proceed with your testimony. And thank you for coming.
Thank you. Bill Leedy, 40-year Juneau resident, small business owner, Alaska Applied Sciences, Inc., one of the eight board members of the Leedy Foundation. I've co-authored about 20 research papers over the last 10 years on alternatives to electricity for transmission. I want to make two points, please. This IRP is extremely valuable because it deviates from the usual IRP, which focuses only on the electricity industry. It has allowed us to broaden our view to include the erosion of space heating. We need to go further. When I was on the Energy Advisory Committee for CBJ, I did a quick analysis of Juneau's internal energy economy. It looks like that. I can give you the file from which this was derived. Electricity is less than a fourth of our energy use. And we have to supply all of our energy, all of our communities, eventually from renewable resources. So we have a much bigger problem than even we have been able to attack in this one. So the message, it's in the public interest, and I assume in the legislature's interest, to solve the complete energy problem for the region in the long term, which requires us to run the whole region on renewables. And that's just the internal energy economy. The external energy economy is invisible to us. That's the airline fuel, the cruise ship fuel, the barge fuel by which we survive here. So it's a much bigger problem. We need to look even beyond this innovative IRP, which gives us the nexus between electricity and space heating. Secondly, the IRP concludes that the interties are uneconomic. As Mr. Harper said, in the public benefit case, it doesn't even make economic sense. It couldn't be profitable. So we have an opportunity as Alaskans, and in the context of this IRP, to look beyond electricity transmission. And that's been the subject of the research papers I've done for the last 20 years. The only alternatives that looks attractive to me is to convert that renewable source electricity at the source, at the site, to anhydrous ammonia and ship it around as a liquid fuel. Very low cost storage, and now we would have an annually firm supply of renewable source energy that may be less expensive as the total system cost than electricity. So we need to think beyond electricity in our definition of transmission. There's other ways of moving energy around and storing it affordably. Thank you.
I sure appreciate your testimony. Next up, we have Brad Sluch. And again, if you could state your name and affiliation for the record, good to see you.
Good to see you. My name is Brad Flitch. I live at 5730 North Douglas Highway. I'm here as an executive committee member of the Alaska Native Brotherhood. I'm also a chartered financial analyst. I've managed money for other people for around 25 years, including the Alaska Permanent Fund. I've prepared a packet for you. I believe it's been all distributed. I believe the most significant and fundamental flaw of this document is the stated objective of minimizing future power supply. That is the second sentence of the first paragraph of the executive summary. By exploring only the options to minimize future power supply, the document excludes many of the hydro resources southeast and completely ignores wind, geothermal, tidal, and wave energy generating capacity. I've included maps from AEA and the Resource Renewable Energy Alaska Project that demonstrates all of those potential power supplies here in Southeast. By not exploring the potential maximum load, the generating capacity in Southeast, the conclusions and pathways the consultant recommends are not valid, and in fact are biased against growth and prosperity. If implemented, will lead to regional deterioration, continued outmigration, and further redistricting. Ignoring the maximum future energy generation option, the consultant never determined Southeast would be able to achieve the economies of scale that export of surplus power would allow. Imagine sizing taps to the demand of the rail belt in 1970 and ignoring the benefits exporting oil has brought the state of Alaska. Affordable energy is a building block of any economy, and Southeast is no different. Locally produced energy builds our local economy and tax base. I view this in terms of gross state product, which is comparable to the national gross domestic product, creating local jobs and circulating the citizens' energy expense in-state as opposed to exporting both to foreign countries, some of which are not our friends, expands gross state product substantially, generating wages, taxes, and demand for other local business services. Imagine all the jobs, secondary processing of our natural resources, harvested from the waters and land of Southeast, and the wealth that it would create. Imagine all the IBEW jobs a 900-mile grid would create, building and maintaining it. After 20 years of economic decline, this SEIRP would lock Southeast Alaska into the worst economic period of time for eternity by minimizing its future power supply, therefore minimizing its future economic vibrancy and forcing future generations to import their energy at the price whims of the global economy. The SEIRP is fundamentally flawed, biased, and because it lacks agreed-upon goals and objectives, is economically invalid and should not be used to develop any energy policies for Southeast Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next up, we have Bob Grimm. Bob, if you could state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Grimm. I'm the CEO of Alaska Power and Telephone. And I'd just like to tell a little bit about our company first, because it does roll into the subject. AP&T is a small investor-owned public utility operating in the state of Alaska, primarily in rural areas. We're kind of unique in that 80% of our equity as an investor-owned company is owned by the current and past employees. The balance is owned by AL&P, the company here in Juneau, and a few scattered institutional investors. AP&T began back in 1957. And over the years, we have reinvested, our employees have reinvested in this region. It's not a huge investment by, you know, a state budget or a federal budget, but it's a lot of money to us. And over the years, what we've seen is a decline in the number of jobs in Southeast Alaska. The most current state Department of Labor projections are some of our communities are going to lose 30% of their people between now and 2034. This is a threat, and this situation could impair our investment. We invested back in Southeast Alaska, and it's important that, you know, that the favor is returned. Our biggest complaint with the existing document is that we believe that there should be a brighter future than is envisioned in this draft. I serve, just like you, a number of communities. In fact, of the 28 communities that Kevin had listed on the board, we're responsible for providing safe, affordable, and electric power free from unreasonable interruption in 12 of those communities. And so we're kind of like a public servant also. I reached out to the communities we serve that have elected officials, and I have one quote I want to share from you from Skagway. This is Stan Selmer. The government of the Yukon Territory is clearly supportive of responsible development. This quote comes from him coming back from the roundup that was recently held in Vancouver, BC. It is an isolated system similar to Southeast Alaska. However, the government there is fully engaged in finding cost-effective solutions to meet the huge increased electrical demands required for those resource developments to be successful. The opposite is true of the Southeast Integrated Resource Plan that has not included or incorporated the large energy requirements associated with the present and future resource development in Southeast Alaska, or even other existing diesel-based loads like cruise ships in its planning. The contrast between the planning approach being used by these similar governments is striking. Even more striking is the governor's Vocal Roads to Resources platform, While the state agency in charge of the planning efforts has presented a draft energy plan that leaves the resource industry homeless. While another state agency, ADA, is here in Skagway trying to increase the ore handling facilities in Skagway to handle the increased demand of ore headed our way from the Yukon. So we object to the proposition of using the low scenario load forecast, which is the basis of this study. All the conclusions and recommendations that come out of this study thus far in this draft are flawed because of that. Whoever made the decision to use the low load forecast, ignore the resource industry, ignore existing loads, and say they're on their own, that's a serious mistake. It has to be corrected because everything in this document, because of that, is flawed. Obviously, if you have no load, you can't support a transmission line. It's just a self-fulfilling prophecy. So that's the point I wanted to get across. I wanted to thank you for the time. Now the good part. This is the best regional integrated resource plan Southeast Alaska has ever had because it's the first. And as seriously flawed as it is, we need to save it. There's people that object to certain things. I do, and strongly do. And I represent people that really resent some of the implications of the assumptions that were made. But those can be corrected. And what we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We have a start. We spend a lot of money with Black & Veatch, $900,000, to collect data and get it all set to put into a model. Unfortunately, when somebody decided what input should be used from that data to run the model, they used the wrong thing. You know, I'm sorry, mistakes happen, but it can be salvaged. And it would be important that we get your support on the committed resources. A lot of those have been talked about for years. They're good projects and should be funded in the near term, and that would give us enough time. Now, you're going to hear people say, well, we're going to update this in 4 years. We don't have 4 years. We have mines in the Upper Lynn Canal, Haines-Skagway area. We got two mines on Prince of Wales. We got a mine here in Juneau running diesels. We have a shipyard that just was bought out in Ketchikan, the Vigor Industry. They get a big job. They're going to come to KPU and say, I need two more megawatts. Well, I hope you brought some diesels because you're on your own. That's not how you run a business. That's not how you attract economic development. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have, Bob Loscher?
Loscher.
Bob Loscher. Thank you. If you could state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Loscher. I live at 10645 Misty Lane, Juneau, Alaska. And I have been kicking around Southeast Alaska for about 40 years. I was involved with the Tlingit-Haida Central Council and their Office of Development Planning and the Tlingit-Haida Housing Authority, Tlingit-Haida Electrical Authority. Even helped Bob Grimm build a hydroelectric plant on Prince of Wales Island called Black Bear Lake Hydroelectric. Then I was involved with Sea Alaska Corporation for about 25 years as their in executive management and their CEO. So I've been around Southeast Alaska quite a bit. I'd like to give you a native leadership perspective about this this plan. And we only have a couple minutes to do so. But our community is suffering economically right now very, very much in the urban and rural communities. The economy is really tough, jobs are hard to get, and the cost of energy, whether it be electricity, gas for your cars, or for space heating, is a huge burden and causes our families to have to trade, you know, pills or pharmacy for heating fuel or food for that, this or that, and it's a real impact on our community. So I want to stress to the legislature that this is really immediate. It's an emergency state, and it's something that needs to be addressed now. This plan is driven by the Alaska Energy Authority and the public utilities, and the it's from their perspective that this plan is drafted. And they try to deal with the immediate near future, and they have these DSM proposals and this wood pellet proposal and this kind of proposal, but it's not going to solve the immediate energy needs of our region. The plan is not tied to public policy issues that the legislature or the national government has laid down. And if you look at the plan, it doesn't have a section here saying our policy goals and objectives need to achieve these public policy laws and goals and objectives. And I think it needs to be corrected in that regard. And I would hope that the legislature will take a hard look at that, at this plan from that perspective. The other thing is the plan is not tied to our regional economic goals and objectives. And our community has basically five industries. It has the fisheries, timber, minerals, tourism, and government. All of these are very fragile in our region right now. One of the things that we need to consider is adding energy as an industrial pillar of our industries in our region. And I really think it's important to do that because it could add to the economy, create jobs, and it could provide a product that we could use not only for our super region, British Columbia and the Western United States, but also could provide for our own region. And the economy of scale of having that as an industry in our region would lift all the different things that we're concerned about, our cost of living, our way of life, our jobs, our industries, our economic development and whatnot. And this plan does not consider that. And I think it's something that our regional leaders need to focus upon. And just to wrap up my comments here is that I'll be submitting a lot of comments to the Alaska Energy Authority about the different parts of this study. But my view at this moment and my counsel to the Native leadership in our region is this, is that this plan is not ready for prime time. It's got a lot more work to do. Even the consultants have identified a whole lot of areas that need more work. And I would hope that the legislature would not use this plan as a basis of policy or a basis for funding our projects that we are advancing at this time among the different communities and the tribal entities and the private sector at this time. And I would hope you would give us a little more time to work on this plan, but please do not use it as a basis of policy or funding for projects on energy in our region. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Loescher. Next, we have Angel Drobnicka. And if you could state your name and affiliation for the record, thank you.
My name is Angel Drobnicka, and I'm the Energy Coordinator for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. Thank you for the opportunity to comment today. Our organization has held a seat on the advisory work group during the creation of the draft plan. The purpose of the IRP was to identify actions that can be taken by residents, businesses, local governments in the state to respond to some significant energy issues facing the region, including the high cost of energy in general and in our region's villages in particular. As you have heard from many others today, this is a very significant issue with no easy answers. We recognize that neither the process or outcome of the IRP is without flaw and that much more work will need to be done. However, we do feel that the process was an important first step and that the plan offers a balanced approach and a good start to addressing the energy issues in the region. I'm going to be directing my comments to the energy efficiency, biomass, and intertie sections of the report. We are very pleased that the plan places a strong emphasis on energy and conservation. This will reduce current and future loads and is the most accessible, cost-effective, and easily achievable ways to meet our energy needs. We encourage the state to engage the public and work closely with regional utilities to design and implement conservation and efficiency programs. We are also glad that the IRP addresses space heating issues and believe there is potential for biomass heat conversions to significantly reduce our dependence on heating oil while saving money and hydropower resources. However, we feel that additional technology should have garnered more attention as part of a diversified approach. Heat pumps, for example, use electricity efficiently and have proven successful in many local applications, such as the Juneau Airport. Black & Veatch's analysis also determined a region-wide intertie system throughout Southeast Alaska to be costly and infeasible at this time. This intertie network has been a prominent focus in past energy planning in Southeast, though little progress has been made. We see some merits in the system, but ultimately are most concerned with addressing critical local needs as soon as possible. We support prioritizing local hydro and other renewable projects, including all of the committed projects that have been identified in the IRP. In addition, the report found that the AKBC intertie was economically unfeasible under both an import and export scenario. At this point in time, the proponents have been unable to show how this project makes economic sense. And without a clear business plan or model, there is strong potential that this intertie would detract from projects that would directly serve needs in our rural communities. While there may be a role for export sometime in the future, we think that the state's first priority is to ensure that all of the needs of Alaskans be met first. And we support Black & Veatch's recommendations that the AKBC intertie should not be a priority for state involvement at this time. Despite its limitations, we are optimistic that the IRP will help Southeast Alaskans address debilitating energy prices by guiding us to use energy more wisely and supporting local renewable projects to address critical needs in our communities. We encourage you to act on its conclusions and thank the Alaska Legislature for its strong support in renewable energy projects. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Drobnicka. And we have a question from Representative Bill Thomas.
Thank you. We're going to renew the Renewable Energy Bill, HB 152.
Okay.
And if people in the audience would say yay or nay, because I think we heard a person before about not going forward. If you want to kill not going forward, then you might have to stop the Renewable Energy Fund. And that's what it sounded like to me. If you want to go forward, there's no reason to be funding the projects that we're looking at. So if people would say yay or nay to, I think it's HB 252 now. Just came out of this committee the other day. It would be interesting for the audience's sake.
Yay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, next up we have Rick Harris. If you could state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rick Harris. My wife thinks I live at 1C Alaska Plaza, Suite 400, but I do live here in Juneau. I'm the Executive Vice President for Sea Alaska Corporation, but I'm testifying today as the Chairman of the IRP. And the working group, or the Alaska Working Group, consisted of approximately 21 members, many of whom you've heard from today and you will hear from more. And I wanted to make sure that kind of the record was clear as what the working group did. Number one, it did support the committed resource projects, and the first action that it did when the committee met was to support those projects and encourage that funding go forward. So that was actually the first and I think a positive step from the working group to move those projects forward. The working group, and I think Kevin Harper described this as a directional document, and I kind of call it a jaw-dropping change or directional document, because there were so many things that were developed in this plan that we had not seen before. Challenges and questioning to the transmission line or the intertie, different kinds of approaches to looking at energy, all of which were very staggering in terms of the public policy that we're dealing with. So for that reason, the committee did not endorse this plan. I want to stress that. The committee did not endorse the plan, but the committee did endorse that it go out for public review and comment. We believe there's a lot of value in the comments that you're receiving, as well as others will be heard, but it is our understanding that AEA and the consultants are committed to listening to those comments in order to ensure that we actually put together a plan that can, in fact, satisfy people's concerns. But at this point in time, the committee and the 21 people who consisted of utilities, city mayors, native corporations, did not endorse that.
with the expectation that we would see more comment, and hopefully the final result will be a strong plan that will, in fact, be a good directional plan and will be one that will be able to lead Southeast through its energy. I want to stress that there was a couple comments on renewable energy, and the plan really did stress that we need to look at all kinds of alternatives, tidal, wave, biomass, not just biomass. I mean, you hear a lot of focus on the biomass. We ourselves are very interested in tidal. We own property close to Bob Grimm's transmission lines, which we think are tidal-type sites, and I keep trying to get help Bob with those. But I think that there are a lot of opportunities there. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude my comments. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Robert V. from Haynes. Is that
Venables?
Venables. There we go. You're well known here. If you could state your name and donation for the record, please. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. My name is Robert Venables. I'm the energy coordinator for Southeast Conference, which is the state's regional development organization and the federally recognized economic development district for Southeast. Just to be very brief, we've been very pleased to participate in the process that's been underway, and thankful for the opportunity that it brings. I think it brings both value to the plan itself to have that kind of regional integration, and it also, you know, for those that are seeking to implement the process, it's just been a good public process project to date. Just to be clear, though, the Southeast Conference and its board of directors, two of whom are watching and listening to me right now, Mr. Denley from Sitka and Mr. Rooney from Wrangell, as well as my executive director, Shelley Wright, the whole membership is in the midst of the review process. And so we're taking a very contemplative and listening attitude toward those comments that are coming forward. But, you know, while no endorsement's been made, there's many findings of this plan that are just, you know, they're consistent already with the work plan, which I make available to you, that Southeast Conference has been working on over the years, as well as some recommendations which you've heard that appear to be no-brainers. So just to make two brief points about the process, which you've heard about already, the Alaska Energy Authority really is to be commended for the effort that they've taken. I think it's somewhat unprecedented to see a state agency actually get into the communities like they have. With this plan, it was not a top-down exercise, you know, from the agency to the communities. We're here to help you. You know, it was actually making themselves and their staff available in the communities, and they were there to listen, to learn, and to present their findings along the way. So I wanted to recognize the agency's efforts throughout the region, because after the kickoff meeting that occurred here in Juneau, other meetings were held in places like Prince of Wales, Ketchikan, Wrangell, Petersburg, Cake, Sitka, Hoonah, Angoon, Haines, Skagway, and Yakutat. And this really allowed very extensive outreach and allowed citizens all over to participate, you know, in both the proceedings of the advisory work group and then public meetings that were held in conjunction with those meetings. So, again, it's been a very good opportunity for people to provide input. But one thing that we really want to do is to make sure that we retain focus on the committed units and some of the immediate needs that do need to happen. There'll be a lot of discussion about potential changes that could occur along the way, and those discussions should be ongoing. But we really do need to see full construction funding for the committed units. And I know the representative talked about the legislative support. If I could just pause and say thank you, because there's been a lot of support from the state for regional improvements in renewable energy projects. But we have identified projects we do need to get built, and we need to get them built now. And so we would hope that we could continue to see that support for those, as well as some support for the space heat recommendations that are out there. So we would hope to see some programs and policies that come into place that would address those. And then the next list of hydros. We know hydros have to be built. We know the ones that we need to build right now. We know there's these 24 that really have a place in our future somewhere, but we're not quite certain where. We really would like to see the agency tasked with making sure that those get analyzed in the very near future, so we can know which ones to build next, because we need to build more hydros in the region. And then the demand-side management energy efficiency measures, I think really many in the region only have a superficial understanding of what that really means and what measures should be taken. And so we're going to need continued assistance in the region. And so some sort of awareness campaign it would be appropriate, I believe, and we want to see those type of discussions go forward. We've been blessed to date. We've made good decisions. We've got the low-hanging fruit. We know which ones the inner ties and which one the hydros have been able to be built. But, we think this IRP can give us the technical insights to help us know which ones to build next. So appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony and to continue this process moving forward. And thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Venables. Next up, we have Sean Florio.
After listening to this, I wanted to go back to my paperwork, and I will submit a written report.
Okay. Thank you. Next up, we have Jan Trigg. Thank you, Jan. If you could state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Jan Trigg. I am the CORE Alaska's Manager of Community Relations and Governmental Affairs. I've been in Juneau for 34 years, and 15 of it have been with the company. We have, CORE Alaska owns and operates the Kensington Mine 45 miles northeast of Juneau. We have 250 employees and up to 100 contractors employed at our project. Our mine site is accessible only by boat and air. We have 6 generators on site to provide all our power needs, and we're not connected to the grid. Once our PACE plan is complete and fully operating, our energy needs will be 8 to 9 megawatts. In this very tight economy, energy costs are one of the few operating costs we can and should be able to positively affect. The basic economics of mining are that the lower the costs, including the cost for energy, it allows for mining a lower grade, which extends the mine life, and the sustainability of a mine. We have high energy costs associated with diesel generation and share this concern with our friends in most southeast communities. The draft SEIRP fails to define exactly what affordable low-cost power is, and it fails to provide a pathway for working towards providing the lowest possible cost power to our communities and existing projects like Kensington. Lowest cost energy provides the opportunity for growth and attracting capital, bringing new industry and creating jobs which will benefit our region. The draft SEIRP fails to plan for future growth and discounts the possibility of a Southeast intertie and an AKBC intertie. In part, it bases its analysis on the premise that mineral development in Southeast Alaska is too speculative. We should not ignore the fact that existing electrical infrastructure currently falls short of the demands not only in Juneau, but in most of the communities in Southeast. We should not plan to fail to plan for our communities and for existing projects like Kensington, Greens Creek, and reasonably foreseeable resource development. We should encourage and plan for projects such as Niblack and Bokan. Our Canadian neighbors are setting an outstanding example as they proactively plan for the current mining boom in British Columbia and Yukon. Alaska should be looking at these projects as a means to an end to develop our hydroelectric resources in Southeast Alaska for the benefit of all. A Southeast intertie and an AKBC intertie is a long-term solution which supports investing in projects which will put power in a grid that increases energy independence and security. CORE Alaska is concerned with the long-term outlook for energy costs, and we encourage any plans to involve alternative energy options as part of an overall strategy for Southeast Alaska. I'd like to thank you for taking time to hold this hearing. This report has the potential of holding the keys to unlock a bright future for Southeast Alaska. However, the current draft does not hold those keys in full. We hope that additional analysis, perhaps a third-party consultant, to verify some of the data and the analysis that was done, will adequately plan for that potential. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And we have a question from Representative Williams.
Thank you for your testimony. Earlier it was mentioned that Kensington was not considered into potential loads because you're working towards some on-site energy options, alternative energy options. Is that true, or is that false information?
At the current time, we've been approached by several different proposals, which are under consideration. At the current time, we do not have a proposal which we have signed and entertained or entered into.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Fred Parody from Alaska Miners Association. If you could state your name and affiliation for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Fred Parody. I'm the incoming executive director of the Alaska Miners Association. And in my new job, this is the first time I've presented before a legislative committee, and I'm very happy to be here today. The Alaska Mining Association was founded in 1939. We have 1,400 members spread across every legislative district in the state. They include prospectors, geologists, engineers, vendors, recreational miners, suction dredge operators, small family mines, junior mining companies, and the major mines, which you heard about today. The association supports the funding and construction of interties, as well as the rationalization of management and control of these intertie systems. The bottom line is we support the development and implementation of strategies to provide stable, low-cost sources of energy to the region, as well as to the region's mines and its mining interests. I forgot to do something I intended to do when I stepped to the microphone. I did leave you each with a brochure. This is a general brochure. This is hot off the press a week ago. It's the economic status of the mining industry in the state. We're very proud to have 4,500 direct mining jobs with an average annual wage of $100,000 a year. We're very proud to have 30 projects that have had individual exploration commitments of expenditures of $1 million last year. And I do want to note on the centerfold on the bottom right is the description of the Niblack property, which is a gold, silver, copper, and zinc property that is moving from the project phase to the mine phase. There's been ongoing exploration there for more than 10 years, and $26 million has been invested since 2009. It has the potential for 200 or 300 jobs. I don't consider those kind of opportunities speculative. They are in process and in development and should be accommodated and accounted for in this kind of long-term regional plan. The AMA advocates for the funding of infrastructure that will provide access to remote areas. This is especially true in the southeast with its bountiful mineralization, and also includes roads between communities such as our capital city here in Juneau. In terms of energy, we believe in a concept that's parallel to the governor's roads to resources, and we want to call it lines to mines. And the previous speaker in discussing the Kensington property could hardly have been more clear about the reality of energy costs and the cost structure of an ongoing property. One of the most difficult issues that faces all Alaskans is the desire to lock up our state. I do want to note that RS-2477 and other efforts to provide access must be maintained. We simply can't afford to lose the ability to create and pioneer new roads to new and promising areas of developments. The more time that goes by, the greater the obstacles to obtaining the use of RS-2477. Finally, we must support the corridors that exist as the result of the efforts of our congressional delegation in the passage of the Safety Lou, the last omnibus national transportation bill. Our mining interests such as that have such promise include Niblack, Bokan Mountain with rare earths, and we support their consideration for the development of roads and interties. We not only support utility and transportation corridors between communities and future mines, we support the development necessary for the rare earth property on southern Prince of Wales, which is Bokan Mountain. Thank you for having a hearing. Thank you for listening to our testimony, and thank you for your support for infrastructure development.
Appreciate you coming here. Thank you. Okay, next up we have, forgive me if I can't read some of these names here. Donald lives on Glacier Highway. Donald Burr? Oh.
Mr. Chairman.
Don Kubley, how is it that I can't read that?
All professors had the same problem.
Bad eyes. Oh, actually, there is a, you are three more down, but since you're there anyway, we'll
there's,
just...
there's another Don on Glacier.
There's another, here. Yeah, there's...
sorry about that.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of the committee, for the record, my name is Don Kubley, and I do live on Glacier Highway. And today I'm wearing a couple hats. Professionally, I'm speaking on behalf of the Alaska Independent Power Producers Association. We have members stretched from Prince of Wales Island all the way to Fairbanks. You've heard from a couple of them today already, and you'll probably hear from a couple more. There are all sources of resources of our power generation, wind, tidal, hydro, and others. But if I might just, on a personal note, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge our family's history. My dad served with your grandfather, and I had the great privilege to work with your dad the whole time he was in this building, he's one of the greatest legislators that's ever walked these halls. Was a great friend, of the highest integrity, vigor, and his legendary sense of humor, and if he was sitting here today, I think I know what he would have to say, and that is, he would say, "You're the best committee chairman I've ever worked with. Who is my son?"
I think I've heard that one before.
The Alaska Independent Power Producers Association, APA, is a membership organization comprised of Alaska's leading Alaska independent power producers and developers. Our members' locations span across the state and represents a growing class of Alaskan entrepreneurs and private companies diligently working to assist our state in developing energy infrastructure to serve our citizens and our businesses. We feel monopolies of any kind inherently do not strive to be the best they can without competition. We strongly feel that if given the chance and support, free enterprise and market demands will dramatically speed up the availability and vastly increase supply of cheap power to our people, our businesses, our industry, and our region. Alaska comprises one-third of the landmass of the United States and is blessed with the equivalent reserves and vast and rich energy resources that we have. These are resources that can and should drive our economy and provide energy independence with reasonable cost power for every citizen of this state. The Alaska Center for Energy and Power at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, funded by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, just released its preliminary overview of stranded renewable energy resources of Alaska. This is a statewide investigation of the huge amount of renewable energy that's stranded in our state. I would like to point out just a couple of the bullet points from that study. One, Alaska has over 677 megawatts of known geothermal capacity, a good portion of which is right here in southeastern Alaska. Number two, Alaska is the largest amount of Class 7 wind in the United States, which is the highest level of wind velocity, and it's the most optimum for wind power. Number three, Alaska possesses 90% of the tidal potential and 50% of the wave energy potential of the whole United States. Number four, Alaska has tremendous hydropower potential with a huge and well-researched amount located right here in the Panhandle. Unfortunately, Southeast Alaska has some of the greatest differences in electrical cost in the nation, as it was pointed out by the folks that did the study. We have interconnected communities on tried and proven hydropower that fuels some community economies, yet merely miles away we have communities paying triple and sometimes six times the same cost for hydropower. These high-cost communities are marked by having no interties, connected to reasonably priced hydropower. Remarkably, the SEIRP fails to connect these relatively simple economic dots. The Southeast Integrated Resource Plan has many problems. First off, the SERP process was flawed in that it ignored key points of our state energy policy with regards to integrating economic development with energy policy. Let me read you a portion of your legislature's 2010 Declaration of Energy Policy from HB 306. That specifically says, two, to encourage economic development by promoting the development of renewable and alternative energy resources, including geothermal, wind, solar, hydroelectric, the hydrokinetic, tidal, biomass for use by all Alaskans. B, promoting the development, transport, and efficient use of non-renewable and alternative energy resources, including natural gas, coal, oil, gas hydrates, heavy oil, nuclear energy for use by Alaskans and for export. C, working to identify and assist with the development of the most cost-effective long-term sources of energy for each community statewide, and D, creating and maintaining a state fiscal regime and permitting the regulatory process that encourages private sector development of the state's energy and resources. Further, in an apparent conflict with our state's energy policy, independent power producers and large users of energy who are in the private sector development of the state's energy resources, we weren't even invited to the SERP working group. Secondly, the SERP appears to be in a centralized planning document that focuses on serving the needs of a dying region, which we want to pivot on, with a governmental finance proposal and solutions rather than planning for the opportunities for private enterprise and business, job creation, regional economic growth from resource development as provided for in Article 8, Section 1 of our Alaskan Constitution. It says, it is the policy of the state to encourage the settlement of its land and the development of its resources by making them available for maximum use consistent with the public interest. Make no mistake, the development of renewable energy in southeastern Alaska, especially hydropower, is consistent with this public interest. Thirdly, consider that one half of Southeast Intertie is already built from Ketchikan to Petersburg and by all accounts is a glowing success, producing some of the lowest cost energy in the region, if not the state, especially places like Fairbanks. Consider further that utility corridor rights of the way illustrated in Public Law 109-59 on Map 92337 provide federally sanctioned routes. We're already given approval to use these, which is you know, as you all know, when you're doing a project, getting federal permits for anything is a nightmare. Federally authorized routes for the Southeast Intertie, along with up to 80% of its funding, and we have an IRP that turns its back on decades of work to accomplish these federal rights. After the success of the Swan Tyee Intertie, abandoning a proven energy transmission success defies common sense. Quitting halfway when you're already winning the game is simply not an Alaskan virtue. One of my father's favorite sayings, and one that I heard virtually every day, was, if a job is once begun, be it big or be it small, do it well or not at all. If he were here today, he would be fighting hard for the completion of this grid and the tapping of the lakes that would provide the God-given power to not only light up the panhandle, but provide a new energy export industry, just like oil or gas, with the surplus not used by our local communities and industries. We are a resilient people here in Alaska, and we pride ourselves on finishing the job. The SEIRP is an about-face and a pivot on that, and on a tried and proven resource development and intertie advocated by previous generations of Southeastern leaders, including your father and grandfather. They knew then, and we know now, that the Southeast Intertie, interconnected with the region's vast energy resources, will provide the impetus to bring in private capital and investments to create jobs, develop wind, wave, hydro, and turn around the Southeast region from a redistricting zone to a prosperous and growing region once again. Please don't get me wrong. This is not a field of dreams, build it and they will come scenario. This is a situation where they're already here, desperately in need and begging for the great amounts of additional electricity that we already have if we just tap it. This is a, if we don't build it, they will go scenario. It's crunch time in Southeast. The SIARP should be scrapped by the legislature and should serve as a warning to other regions that centralized planning with the AEA and outside contractors that fails to follow state policy and fails to include private sector is a non-starter. Any future regional planning must follow legislatively mandated state energy policy and be closely coordinated with private industry leaders, community and elected officials, power project developers, and mines to spur our economy. Any future working group must include the full spectrum of all industries and participants in a transparent and open process that prizes economic feasibility, replaces political plums with costs of transparency, and strives to achieve in lowering energy costs to the citizens and businesses of our region and state. APA and its members dream of a future where the currently stranded renewable energy resources of Alaska made available to fuel our local economies, our state, and the rest of our nation. It's not very often that you face a crossroads like we are in front of today. The question is, do we face backwards and retreat merely to survive, or do we meet the challenge, follow the state energy policy that was put forth by our leaders, and march forward together to remove technical, logistical, and economic barriers and allow free market forces and private Alaskan energy enterprise to flourish? I ask that you choose the wisdom of this body and the state energy policy and send the IRP back to the AEA with a failing grade. At a Native forum just the other day, your speaker, Representative Chenault, when asked about the need for PCEs for schools, businesses, and community governments here in Southeastern, he responded like this. He said, that would be a short-term band-aid fix. What is really needed, wherever possible, is a completed power grid surging with cheap electrons. The speaker's clear vision of what is truly needed in the panhandle is greatly appreciated by all residents, businesses, and communities in our region not already receiving electricity from our abundant, inexpensive, renewable, and green hydropower source. We applaud the governor for his high priority and frequent expressions of strong support to create new jobs and industry in the state by building roads to resources. We couldn't agree or support him more on this. However, not to include high voltage lines on or under the roads means that once the road reaches those resources development projects, there's no electricity there to power the project. Accordingly, and it was mentioned earlier by Fred, it's a great line. The governor responded to it ecstatically, and that was, with those roads to resources, is lines to mines. I've taken up way too much time, and I appreciate your patience, Mr. Chairman. You know, there's a couple pictures in this room that I think are very important. If we had cheap electric power in this region, we could process our own minerals right here in the state and send out ingots instead of barges full of minerals. All we need is electricity. If we had cheap power to our communities, we could have more coal storages and more canneries and create jobs that would bring our children back after they're done with college. Right now, we're in a death spiral. And the one thing that is going to change that is a new industry that not only provides cheap power to our people, but allows us to help our friends and neighbors on the West Coast.
Thank you, Donald, for your testimony, and I just want to say that you are the best testifier that we've had in the past 6 minutes, so thank you.
That's a foster comment. You're so proud. That's a foster comment.
Okay, next up we have... So Donald Burford was not here, is that correct? Oh, and you will be...
He's going to say
in writing. Okay. 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 And then earlier we had a Sean. I think it was Florio, and that person's not here. Next up we have an Albert Howard. Is that correct? Oh, let me rephrase that. Mayor Albert Howard from Angoon. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Distinguished representatives, let me paint a picture for you to begin with before I give my presentation. We live 60 miles from Juneau. We pay 67 cents a kilowatt. We are exactly 32 miles from a line that was built to a mine. It seems at some point, you know, I've listened to the downward spiral. I see it firsthand. There's 400, I represent 466 people in my community. Whether they voted for me or not, I stand here trying to make a better life for them. I listened to Don Kubley. He's looking at these pictures. I looked at this one, the pipeline. What if we listened to the people that said we should never build that? It costs too much. Look at the return on the investment. I know the return on the investment and the impact it would have on my community if we build the intertie. The things you're not hearing in these reports are the human aspect of the benefits of building the intertie to our community. I'm also a veteran. There's 25% of my community are veterans. 25% of the men there serve the country. there's a phrase that's been around Southeast Alaska, that Southeast Alaska is the Saudi Arabia of hydro. That came from a veteran that has served and walked the same sands that I did during Desert Storm and Desert Shield. That's where that phrase came from. I don't want to see my two sons have to do what I did. Granted, I love this country and every possibility that comes with it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and distinguished representatives, for the opportunity to address my concerns with the Southeast IRP. Our concerns include the lack of meaningful public process, the lack of real goals and objectives, the document by AEA to deny grants requested in an arbitrary and capricious manner. We are seeing the public benefit described for the first time and look forward to understanding the assumptions and reviewing the numbers associated with Brockton Beach presentation. My concerns start with the public process. The public process that seemed to be non-existent until these public hearings. Now I can finally ask, why were private meetings held in Seattle with select stakeholders who seemed to benefit the most under the draft document? Why were hearings not held in all communities and tribal governments in Southeast Alaska, as this was stated? We hear Southeast Conference was brought to provide local knowledge, but when asked, they say their role was to set up meetings and provide administrative support. Who is to provide local knowledge? The idea, if it was not the communities and the public, why were comments and concerns not posted on the AEA website in a timely manner? A manner so the public could follow the IRP process. As elected officials for the community of Angoon, we asked for the West Admiralty segment of the Intertie. To be carefully looked at. We evidenced by passing resolution 11-15, of which provided a copy. The reasons we asked for that, due in part to keeping the Intertie cost as low as possible and have access to low cost power. If vetted, we would not only help ourselves with our struggles to get low cost power, but we could help the state by eliminating the need to provide Angoon with PCEs. If we had 11 and 14 cents per kilowatt that larger communities enjoy, Angoon would no longer need PCEs. Those funds could be used where there is no renewable energy resource available. Such a long-term solution would be consistent with Article 8, Section 1 of the Constitution of Alaska, where it states, natural resources are to be shared in the common maximum benefit of the public. Unfortunately, by not allowing public fully into the process and disconnecting our suggestions, basically ignoring support for the Southeast IRP, fails to move forward as it should. Under Article 1, Section 8 of our Constitution, it is a policy of the state to encourage settlement of its lands, development of its resources by making available maximum use consistent with public interest. I have a favorite quote that guides me. The best government for the people is the government closest to the people. To me, that says the City Council of Angoon best represents our citizens, not some bureaucrat. Our Constitution gives clear direction concerning the well-being of all citizens of Alaska. And that consultant or public official should not be telling us 35 cents per kilowatt is best for us, when we and our citizens in Angoon deserve 11 and 14 cents if we can come up with a plan that gets us there. October 29th, 2011, I submitted comments and concerns. I have yet to receive a response. Any kind of response from AEA or the contractor. The draft discounts our suggestion, effectively ignores our input, and in an effort to achieve our own goals, our other unknown goals, in this case perhaps keeping status quo and separation between communities and utilities. Executive summary states the IRP isn't a policy-making document, but it is. I have proof. That shows this document was used to decide not to fund two renewable projects under Round 5. In fact, AEA denied our application before the document was released in draft form, citing the intent of the IRP. Other reasons given for not funding the project based on the IRP were it isn't consistent with findings of the IRP. Thomas Bay project cited in the work per Executive Order 230, including Ruth Lake and Senior Lake, the potential of these projects is 70 megawatts. In fact, both projects are storage projects. These preliminary permits are held by the City of Angoon. Projects that the IRP said should be studied further, yet which were turned down by AEA for funding based that they were inconsistent with the IRP. The Southeast Integrated Resource Plan is conceptually a good idea, as it will ensure the focus on where we should be heading for the future of Southeast Alaska energy needs. Looking at household savings is just one aspect. The quality of life and hope for the future.
You have to excuse me. The people I work for, I see every day. Every day. I walk to work. I talk to them about their concerns. This comes from them.
We're happy to take your comments in writing, too, also, if you would like. Either way, though, if you want to continue, if you need
Thank
another
you, Mr.
moment.
Chairman, I'm just about to the end.
Okay.
Before the IRP achieves these goals, the document must be updated with more than just the opinion of status quo that has brought us to this point in time. We cannot solve today's problems with the same thinking that has got us into these problems to begin with. Thank you again for allowing me to speak and be a part of this process.
Thank you, Mayor Howard. We appreciate you coming in and you know, for everybody here, I think this has been valuable. I'm just appreciative that you're all able to stay here a little longer. I stand corrected. I did not think that we had another committee after this, but we do. Corrections is waiting to come in here. So what we're going to do here is we can do two things. I think electronically we can receive comments electronically. Also, the public comment period is open until March 19. We can forward those on to the AEA. I think we're looking at maybe, and I'm conferring with my co-chair here, possibly a Tuesday, next Tuesday. Is that what we're thinking, to accept further public testimony on this? Or do we need to wait a little bit longer here?
We might do that, but we might want to reschedule then one of the two items that we were going to discuss.
Okay. We'll have that posted, but we're looking at taking more testimony next week so that people have an opportunity to get that in with us here. So so with that, I do apologize, and I think next committee meeting is going to be at 3 o'clock on Tuesday, February 14, 2012. The committee will be hearing HB 294, an act relating to the power cost equalization program, and this meeting is adjourned at 5:27 p.m., and again, thank you all for coming.